could turn in your Bibles this morning to John chapter 21. John chapter 21. We're going to look at verses 1 through 19. The Gospel of John, it's in the New Testament. It's the fourth book in the New Testament. Now, today's passage is actually a pretty popular one. So even if you're someone who's new to church, you've never been to a church before, or maybe this is your first time back to a church, you may have heard this story before. And I want to give a kind of a framework before we read the passage, because I think that it's helpful to know exactly what's happening in this context. Now, a month ago when we had our first preview service, I preached on Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Luke chapter 5. And in that passage, we talked about Jesus calling his disciples. In fact, the first disciple that he called in that passage that we looked at was Peter. We talked about how God really, he sees, Jesus saw all of Peter, and yet he still chooses Peter despite whatever brokenness, mess-ups, sinfulness, wickedness, any of those kind of harsh words that might sound harsh to you, or it sounds harsh to me sometimes, any of those harsh words, despite all those things, God sees us, and he still chooses us. Now, Peter then, he leaves his nets behind, he stops being a fisherman, and now he's a full-time disciple of Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't be a fisherman and a disciple at the same time. It just meant now he was following Jesus wholeheartedly. He was leaving his life behind. Peter had a firsthand witness to everything about Jesus after that moment. He witnessed all of Jesus' miracles, his healing power, his teaching with authority. He witnessed everything. He was one of the inner folks, in fact, that Jesus was showing and demonstrating all these things to. He even saw Jesus raise someone from the dead, okay? So I want to give you this sense, okay, because Peter now, all of a sudden, he's invited into this extraordinary life with Jesus, and it leads up a few years later where he actually gets so caught up in what he's going to do for God, because Jesus says to him, on you I'm going to found my church. On you I'm going to build this incredible movement that you're going to lead. And so Peter gets all worked up, and then there's this moment, though, right, where Peter gets worked up, and he's basically like, I'll go anywhere with you, Jesus. And Jesus says, actually, you're going to deny me 3 times. And Peter's like, whatever. I'm not going to deny you. And Jesus says, okay, just watch. And so what ends up happening, of course, and this is a very popular story, here's Peter, this rambunctious, excitable person who's following Jesus, and what does he do? He denies Jesus 3 times. And he's totally crushed by it. He starts weeping outside the gate, right? Because he's so crushed. He's actually betrayed Jesus when he got all puffed up about who he was. All of a sudden now, he's crushed. He's ashamed. He's like, I can't believe this. I was talking this big game. Talking this big game like I'm somebody. And yet, here I am. And I just denied Jesus. But that's not the end of the story. Jesus rises again. He resurrects. Right? Because Peter basically thinks he's betrayed Jesus. Jesus goes to his death. All of a sudden now, Peter is completely crushed, and he's like, what in the world is going on? But what? That's not the end of the story. Jesus has risen from the dead. He's alive. It's a whole new story. It's a whole new ball game. Even though Peter messed up, it's a whole new ball game for Peter. And so we find ourselves now in this text, in John chapter 21. Here's this excitable Peter, and we have this episode where Peter is reinstated by Jesus. And we're going to see some clues in this text that actually reveal what I believe are things that are similar to all of us as human beings. So, John chapter 21, verses 1 through 19. This is the reading of God's word. This is what it says. It says, afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and 2 other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter said. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Everyone say nothing. That's very encouraging. Thank you. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net and because of the large number of fish. Does this remind you of the story we talked about last month? This is crazy. Here's Jesus just like, throw the nets over there. Okay, we'll do it. And all of a sudden, there's just loads of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. Here's Peter, so excitable again, right? The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught, and let's eat." Amen. Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." The disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. This is the third time he's appeared to them, but there's been 4 stories, actually, and we'll talk about that. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, now here's the popular point in the passage, which many of us have probably read before. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter in particular, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said. "You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to them, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." Okay, that was a mouthful. I read all 19 verses because I think this passage is dripping with such incredible richness. Now, this is actually the fourth time that Jesus appears after he's resurrected in the book of John. Because in the book of John, aside from appearing twice to the disciples, the first time he appears to Mary Magdalene, who goes and she's actually by the tomb. And she's wondering, "What in the world? The tomb is open. There's no one inside." And what happens? She says to these angels, like, "Please show us where he is. Please return his body." And Jesus appears miraculously. It's really this incredible scene. It's like, because Mary Magdalene thinks that he's the gardener, it's almost like supernatural. And then, later on, he appears to the disciples twice, again in a supernatural way. They're all huddled up in the upper room. They're really scared because they don't know what's happening. Their leader has just died. And all of a sudden, the disciples, they've locked their doors. And what happens? Jesus appears miraculously. Another supernatural event. Then the third time is this, is Doubting Thomas. He's another disciple. He comes, and all of a sudden, Doubting Thomas is like, "I don't believe you guys." And they're like, "We just saw him. I'm telling you." Right? And he's like, "I don't believe you. Unless I put my hands in on his feet and on his hands, then I'm not going to believe you." And what does Jesus do? In a miraculous way, he shows himself. And he says, "Touch my hands, my feet." Now, all of those are very incredible supernatural moments. And yet, here in this passage, look what it says in verse 1. It's really kind of crazy because Jesus has appeared in these 3 miraculous ways. Then all of a sudden, it's just this ordinary day. What does Peter do? It says this. He appears, and then Simon Peter, basically, 2 other disciples were together, and this is what Peter says. "Let's go fishing. Let's go fishing. I'm going to go fishing." They're like, we'll come too. Now, the heart of this passage, before I get into some of this, the heart of this passage is basically, it's clear that Jesus is reinstating Peter. Why? Because he's 3 times he asks him, "Do you love me?" later on. It was 3 times that Peter had betrayed Jesus. Also, it talks about they were around a burning coals, around the fire. That is the same context. Earlier, Peter was around a burning fire when he denies Jesus. So this passage is so tied in to when Peter actually betrays Jesus. There's so many similarities here. So it's clear that Jesus is reinstating Peter. But what's really puzzling about this passage is this. Is in this exchange that Peter has with Jesus. Basically, this is what Jesus says. "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And what does Peter say? He says, "Yes, Lord. You know I love you." And then Jesus says, feed my lambs. Can everyone say that? Feed my lambs. That's kind of weird, isn't it? What do you mean? He just said he loves you. Now you're saying, feed my lambs? What does that mean? Right? It would make more sense, for instance, if Jesus, like, this exchange would make more sense to me. If Jesus says to Peter, Simon Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, yes, Lord, you know I love you. And then Jesus says, Peter, I knew that and I love you too. Go and be my disciple, right? Or, you know, if Jesus had basically said, Peter says, yes, Lord, you know I love you. And then Jesus says, yes, go and take that love to an unloved world so that it can be loved again by me. Like some sort of love element there. But it's really strange. He says, feed my lambs. What? What is he saying? What does that have to do with anything? Well, see, the clue is actually found in verse 15. Look in scripture. Look what it says in verse 15. It says in verse 15, when they had finished eating, this is what Jesus says to Simon Peter. He says, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? Okay, feed my lambs and truly love me more than these. What are you getting at, Drew? What is he talking about here? When Peter basically is talking to Jesus, and Jesus says, do you love me more than these? What are the these? Some commentators have said, oh, it's probably the disciples. Do you love me more than these disciples? But that doesn't make sense, because elsewhere, there's nowhere else where there's this moment where Peter shows that he loves the disciples more than Jesus. That's something that's very rare. So what's he talking about when he asks him, do you love me more than these? It's the fish. It's the boat. The nets. It's all these things. And what Jesus is asking Peter is this. He's saying, Peter, do you truly love me more than the fish, than the nets, than the boats, than the life that you left behind? Why in the world are you still fishing? I called you to something extraordinary. I said, on you, I'm going to build my church. I have something in you that I see in you that is much greater and deeper than you see even in yourself. Why in the world are you still fishing? I'll tell you why. I mean, if I were Peter, I would understand too. You see, the reason Peter's fishing is because that's what's comfortable. That's what he knows. He's just gone through this incredible roller coaster with Jesus. I mean, just watching the New York Rangers is like an emotional roller coaster, or the New York Knicks this past season, right? I kind of like doing that, by the way. It's just an incredible roller coaster. And can you imagine the roller coaster that Peter's been through? He sees all these miracles of Jesus. He actually gets to perform some of these. He starts walking on water, and then he falls into the water. He starts believing that Jesus is going to do something extraordinary and take back the kingdom, and then Jesus dies. And then Jesus is resurrected. He's alive. I mean, it's this emotional roller coaster that Peter's been through. And what does Peter do after this? He's just so emotionally spent from everything. This is what he says. I want to go fishing. I just want to go back to, you know what, things are kind of crazy. And you know what, I actually was responsible for so much of the pain that happened. And I don't want to mess up like that again. Because you know what happened is, like, I actually was supposed to be there for Jesus, but I messed up. And you know what, Jesus? You're probably going to call someone else to be your disciple. Call John, the disciple you love. Because you know me? I'm just going to go fishing. Because that's just what I do. And that's, you know what? I think you should probably give up on me. I think, you know what? I'm better off just as a fisherman. Just let me go back. And here's what Jesus is saying. No. I'm not letting you off the hook. He says, no, Peter, do you love me more than these? Because I'll tell you what, I still have a calling for you to feed my sheep, to be a leader, a shepherd amongst this community. Do you love me more than these? He says, yes, Lord, you know I love you. And this is when Jesus, three times, what he's saying to him is, Peter, I believe in you. I trust you. I want you to live your life with a sense of meaning and purpose. Why go back to fishing? Has this ever happened to you before in your life? Maybe you've been a Christian for a while, or maybe this is your first time coming back to a church. Or maybe this is the first time going to a church and your view of God is kind of like Peter's. Is that first when you meet God, there's this message of God, his grace is wide and deep, and he loves you, and he's going to use you, and that his forgiveness is so wide, and you say, God, that's the God that I want to fall in love with. That's the God that I want to follow. And you end up saying, yes, I follow this God, this Jesus, who loves me, who sacrificed himself. But the longer you become a Christian, you realize, oh man, things are kind of hard. It's kind of hard to live this Christian life. And it's so hard. In fact, it's full of these emotional ups and downs. And to tell you the truth, I don't think I live up to the standard that God has for me. Therefore, what I'm just going to do is I'll come on Sundays, and you know what? I'll just go back into my casual Christian life. I'll call myself a Christian. I'll go on Sundays, but the rest of my life, I'm just going to, you know, I'll go through the motions, and I just know how to fish. Just let me go back to fishing. We do this all the time, don't we? Now, why in the world do we do this? I really came up with two reasons that I'm going to talk about. There are many reasons, but I'm just going to talk about two of them. Why do we do this? Why do we go back to fishing? God calls us to something extraordinary, unique even, but we go back to fishing. Why in the world do we do that? The first word that I want to talk about is shame. Last month, we talked about how Peter's completely full of shame. He says, get away from me. I am a sinful man. And here, Peter's doing the same thing. He's like, you know what? I'm just going to go back fishing because, geez, I was so arrogant. I mean, I told you that I would go to death for you, and I denied you three times. You're not going to use me anymore. I didn't pass the test, Jesus, so you know what? Just let me go back to fishing. Do you see the shame there? The feeling like I'm just not worth it. Feeling like, you know what? I've made too many mistakes. I'll leave the Christian journey to more expert superstar Christians like Pastor Drew. Thanks, Ed. Thanks. There's a part of us that do this, don't we? We basically, there's a shame, and it comes really through this idea that God expects us to be perfect. And so, as a result, we expect of ourselves to be perfectionists. One pastor put it this way, perfectionism is the highest form of self-abuse. Some of you, though God has forgiven you, you're still paying for sins that you committed years ago. Some of you are still living out the scripts that you've been given, not from God, but from your family that told you you'll never amount to anything. From people who have judged you, who have told you that, oh man, you don't belong in God's kingdom. Surely someone like you can't be accepted or used even by God. Do you hear these insidious voices? I think there are so many of us, whether we're Christian or not, who wrestle with this whole idea of perfectionism. Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan priest, he wrote this, and it was fascinating. Actually, he didn't write this. He spoke this, and I was so moved by this because he said when he was younger and he was a priest, it's interesting that some of the religious people are some of the most perfectionistic. They can't accept themselves. And so he said when he was younger and he would actually forget something from, like, his apartment, and he'd go out. And he would leave, and then he'd be with people, and he'd be talking to them, and he'd be like, oh, I can't believe I forgot that again, you know? And his friends would be like, yo, relax. And he's like, Richard, you're such an idiot. And he realized that he suffered from perfectionism, so that he calls himself an idiot for just forgetting something at his apartment. He said now that he's gotten older and he reflects on his life, he realizes, he says, he forgets something and there's this urge within him to start condemning himself again, to start ravaging himself. And what does he do? Instead now, he said a few years have given him this perspective where he laughs at himself. And he says, oh, Richard, you're making the same mistake again. But you know what? God still loves you and God still wants to use you. And you don't have to get on yourself about forgetting something from the apartment. Some of us need to learn how to forgive ourselves. You're still paying for sins that you committed. And that God says, listen, if you want forgiveness, I'll forgive you. But you don't have to be your worst enemy anymore. You can actually be free. What are the shames that you're wrestling with today? The shames that tell you, you know what, Jesus, okay, to be like someone who really follows you, I don't think I can go there because you want someone a little bit more spectacular, like Pastor Drew. But there's this sense in which we do that. There's this shame element, like, oh man, and we're still paying for these things. And Jesus says, listen, why in the world are you still fishing? The second reason that I wanted to give, not only shame, but it's comfort. It's just comfort. You know, why does Peter go back to fishing? It's because, man, he's been through an incredible roller coaster of a journey. And now all of a sudden, what does he want to do? He just wants to go back to what's comfortable. Peter, why are you fishing? I don't know. It's because I know how to fish. Jesus, can you just get off my back about following you? I just want to fish. It's fun. You could see this in Peter, right? I mean, it's so comfortable. And oftentimes this is what happens, is that God calls us to this extraordinary life, and what we say is, actually, yeah, thanks, but actually, it's comfortable. As human beings, this is what we do. We just naturally gravitate towards what's comfortable and familiar. The thing, though, is that God calls us to something more radical in the way that we handle our finances, in the way that we handle our sexuality, in the way that we do our relationships, in the way that we do our parenting. God calls us to something radical. But honestly, for us, sometimes inside of us, there's just a much more comfortable way, and we're just like, God, just stop bothering me. I'll come every Sunday, but you know what? I just want to live this way because it's more comfortable. I just want to fish. Leave me alone. You can see I struggle with this. We gravitate towards comfort. There's actually a class that I taught in a community close by in Ravenswood, and it was called How to Avoid Marrying a Jerk. Some of you guys have been in that class, I know. Some of you want to take that class now. You're like, sign me up. Some of you, can I do it if I'm married? No, don't. Okay, it's for singles. Yes, some of you are, yeah. So anyhow, what's interesting about this, the class, is one of the points that we make is this, is that oftentimes in a dating relationship, okay, singles, you might want to take notes here. I'm just kidding. Married folks, you want to as well. But in dating relationships, we talk about how premarital insight and change is easier than marital insight and change. Let me repeat that. Premarital insight and change is easier than marital insight and change. Now, those of you who are married are like, I wish I knew that before, right? Because what ends up happening inevitably in a relationship is this. And maybe if you've dated for a while, you kind of know that this is what happens in a relationship. In the beginning, everyone's putting their best foot forward, I think. Okay, if you want to continue dating, yes, you should do that, okay? You put your best foot forward in the beginning, and for the first 3 months, you're everything's cool, your appearance, everything. You don't want to make any kind of waves. You just want to act cool and chill and like you got everything together and dress nice and wear a tie and everything. And so what happens in a dating relationship is we put our best foot forward, and because things are so tenuous during that time, we're all looking to change to conform to how this relationship is going to be. But folks who are married, I think we can all attest to this. After we get married, after we've tied the knot, it's like, whoa. It's like these bad habits, just this way of relating that now or that we're used to. We just get back into the same way of relating. Why? It's just because human, there's a word that I learned in biology in seventh grade. It's this word. It sounds kind of fancy, but I want you to repeat it after me. It's called homeostasis. Can you all say that? Homeostasis. Right? If you learned about homeostasis, it's basically when you get into neutral and then you're just coasting, you're gliding. The human condition is part of that. We constantly move towards homeostasis. We just want to get regular. And that's why for marriages, we want to encourage marriages to continue working on your marriage. It doesn't matter if you've been married for 5 years, 5 months, or 50 years. Each of us need to continue to be growing in our relationship. Otherwise, we reach homeostasis. And homeostasis just means, oh, I just revert to what's comfortable and easy, and that's what I want to do. And some of us in our Christian journey, that's what we do. God calls us to a heroic life, and yet we just go towards homeostasis. There's a woman I was counseling years ago, and I remember as I was counseling her, it was interesting. She came from a very abusive family. Her father, and he passed this down to other generations, to his sons. They just had a view of women that was very demeaning. And she experienced a lot of abuse from at the hands of her father, as well as towards her mom. And so it was interesting. She was going through her own journey of looking for a relationship. And sure enough, what would happen is she found herself in a number of relationships where she was constantly being abused physically, like violently. And it came to a point where I said to her, why are you doing this? She said, I know I need to change. And so what happened actually was she broke off one relationship where someone was physically abusing her. And then she went and she started dating someone that was actually really kind, really good-natured, was not physically abusive at all. And I was so thrilled for her. And so she starts dating him. And then a few months later, she tells me, she goes, oh, I broke up with him. It's like, why? She said, I don't know. It's kind of boring. I don't know. It's like, oh, okay. She ends up going back to the boyfriend that she was with before, who physically abused her. And we were talking about this later, and she ended up breaking that off, thankfully. And I was like, it's so easy. I said, why did you go back to him? She said, it just felt comfortable, felt like home. That's a very extreme example, but some of us, we have this in us, and this is what God says. He says, I want to invite you to actually live a radically different life, a radically different reality where you reorient your perspective on everything. In fact, I want you to feed my sheep. I want you to shoot for a calling that's above and beyond anything you anticipated. In the way that you love, in the way that you're generous, in the way that you speak truth to people, in the way that you relate to people, in the way that you actually spread my kingdom. But what happens, though, is we're like, oh, but it's so easy to be this way. So easy just to go fishing. I was thinking about this in my own life, and one of the things, my own journey is my father had a just kind of an up-and-down relationship with my father. He was also very abusive when I was growing up, and we always had a distant relationship. One of the wounds I realized as I thought about my relationship with my father is that he was just very unavailable to me. Like, my brothers and I, we were latchkey kids. We went everywhere, kind of rode our bikes everywhere. And we ended up, playing a lot of sports as well. And my father didn't come to any sport. I played 3 sports in high school. He didn't come to one game, except once when he came to one half of my junior varsity football game. I'm not bitter. Anyhow, no, I'm just kidding. But anyhow, I've worked through this. And what's interesting is that, so I said to myself, and my wife and I, we just had a son. And he's 4 months old. And, my wife said to me, she said, one of the reasons why my dad was always so absent was because he worked all the time. He was a workaholic. Just constantly working. So I rarely saw him. And when I did see him, he was abusive. So part of me wanted him there. Part of me didn't want him there. And so one of the things that I was wrestling with was my wife said, hey, I just think that you should probably really think about your work ethic is pretty strong too. And your life is going to have to be reoriented with your son. Our son. And I was like, okay. And so what's happened in my wife and our relationship right now is in the mornings, she handles, in the night, he's still getting up every 3 hours or so. And in the mornings, I spend extended time from like 6 to about 9 with him, my son, just hanging out with him and stuff. But I realize in me, and I've been very kind of cognizant of, I really want to be present for my son, like fully engaged with him. I want to be there for him. And here he is, he's 3 months old. And so I'm holding him from 6 to 9 o'clock. That's 3 hours, that's a long time. So I'm holding my son, and he doesn't really do anything. He's just standing there, right? He's just like, so I'm just kind of like, I'm wasting time, I'm not doing anything, I gotta be more productive. So what do? There's this thing called a Bjorn. I don't know if you've ever heard of one of these things. It's kind of one of these seats where you put the baby in and it kind of bounces up and down. And so I'm like, thank God for Bjorns. Because I'm holding him, and he's just looking around. He goo-goos and gaga sometimes, and I'm like, oh, how cute. And we're just sitting there. So there's something in me that just wants to get things done, though. We're planting a church, have a lot to do. So what do? I take the baby, and I put him in the Bjorn. And I'm like, hi, baby. And he starts smiling at me. And then he plays, and this is what my son does. He starts looking down at, because on the Bjorn, there's this thing with a lot of, like, roly toys. And he starts looking down, and he starts playing with it. Right when he looks at those toys, I go to my computer, and I just start emailing, catching up on stuff, and there's my son, and I look at him, and I make sure he's smiling, and then all of a sudden, right, he stops, he looks down, and then I'm like, shh. Now, check this out. I was really convicted by this, because I'm like, God, I need to be present. I need to be present, and my son's doing that, and he smiles at me, then he looks down, and then I work, and then, no joke, I look back at him. Whenever I look back at him, he's looking at me like this. Like, what? 4 months old. And as I was thinking about just my wife and I in our conversation about how there's something in me that's come from my family of origin, from my father. And it's not that working hard is a bad thing, but not being present with my son. And I realized, wow, this is going to take some difficulty to actually reorient my life to behave differently. Otherwise, I just go into homeostasis mode. I only do what I've been taught to do, what I've caught from my family of origin. I only do what I know what's comfortable. I only want to go fishing, and here's what Jesus says. No. I got something else for you. I got something else. I've called you to something extraordinary. Why in the world are you still fishing? You know what? God is more committed to you than sometimes you are to yourself. That's why he keeps going after Peter. He's more committed to you than sometimes you are to yourself. Some of us have reverted back towards comfort or to shame, and God says, no, I'm not going to let you off the hook. Why are you still fishing? I have something extraordinary for you. I want to make you into a better husband, a better wife, a better parent, a better single person. Like, I want to transform you, and you're just like, no, homeostasis. And God's like, no, I have something better for you. Don't settle for mediocrity. Don't settle for just the mundane. Will you pursue the extraordinary life that I have for you? And you know what? It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. It's going to cost much. But God says, I invite you to this journey. Notice that what Jesus says, though, is this. Jesus doesn't say, Simon, son of Jonah, right? He says, he even doesn't call him Peter. He says, Simon, son of Jonah, you've reverted back to being Simon, son of Jonah. You're not even living as Peter, the person I've called to be the rock. He says, Simon, son of Jonah. He says, do you love me? He doesn't say, Simon, son of Jonah, do you revere me? Because you better revere me, because I'm God. And if you don't change your life, you're going to be messed up, okay? He doesn't say, like, hey, Simon, son of Jonah, after all I did for you, you're going to go back fishing? Come on, get yourself off the ground. He doesn't guilt trip Peter. He doesn't, like, strangle Peter and be like, what in the world are you doing after all I've done for you? He says, do you love me? Have you been captured by my love? Have you been captured by this relentless pursuit where I would do anything for you, even give my life for you? Do you love me? And if you love me, then will you live for something that's bigger than just the comfort or the shame? Will you actually walk into a destiny where you're not beating yourself up for sins that you committed years ago or days ago or months ago, but will you actually walk into a new destiny that I have for you? We're going to end with this prayer, and I'm going to invite the worship team to come forward, and I'm going to ask you, worship team is just going to play a little bit something in the back, and I'm going to end with this prayer that I'm going to invite you to read along with me. It's going to be behind me. And I'm going to allow you to read it. We're going to read it aloud together once. And then we'll have a time of just listening to some of the instruments. But we'll flash up that prayer. And I want you just to reflect on this prayer. Because there's some of us in this room this morning who are, we realize that's what our Christian life has become. Or some of us who have, this is our first time at a church. And we're just kind of like, you know what, actually, this Christianity thing, this idea that Jesus is here and that he loves us and that he doesn't give up on us and that we can make mistakes, it's one of the most inclusive religions there is, because he says you can make mistakes and I'll still love you and I'll use you. You don't have to be expert PhD person in Bible. You don't have to be a pastor. You can actually just be who you are and let me release you into something extraordinary. So we're going to flash up the prayer, and I'm going to read it, and I'm going to invite you to read it along with me right now. And we're going to read it, and then I'm just going to allow us to meditate on it. It's by this fellow named Thomas Merton. Let's see. Can you see that okay? You could close your eyes if you want. I'm going to invite you to read it along with me, though. Let's all read together. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. Ben, can we put the previous slide up there? I'm going to read it. I'm going to ask you to, let's all stand, and I'm going to read this for you. The next one after this. I'm just going to read this over you. If you could just open up your palms to the sky, and I'm going to read this, and will you receive this prayer? Will you pray this yourself? Lord, I believe that the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. God, I know that you don't want to guilt trip me. You don't want to strangle me, but you invite me. And I pray that what you would do is, as each of us are standing here with our hands raised to heaven, that you would transform our hearts, that you would give us courage, that you would give us the faith, that you would give us humility, that you would give us the tenacity to want to follow you, to not be resigned to comfort or to shame, but actually to really follow you. And God, I pray that for each person here, if there is just an inkling of a desire to follow you, to get off of, Lord, fishing, the comfortable life, the addictions that we carry, I pray if any of those things are what we're wrestling with, I pray that you would break those things in the name of Jesus. I pray that you would honor the desire to want to please you. We may not know the future, but God, we want to love you, and I pray that you would give us the courage to do that.